This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The UNC University system has a new leader. Former U.S. Secretary of Education Margaret Spelling starts her new job as system president today. Board of Governors selected Spellings in October to replace Tom Ross, who was forced to resign. Margaret Spellings joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank. I'm excited to be here.
First day on the
job.
On
day one.
Day one, you're spending your lunch hour with us.
I am. Actually, I'm not. I'm going to have lunch with students at NC Central. After we leave here.
Well, it's just down the road. Well,
exactly.
Thank you for coming. So, but let's talk about that because it's your first day and yet you face controversy even before today. Your selection has met with criticism on and off campus. How do you approach starting the job under these circumstances?
Well, what I'm going to work on doing is finding common cause and common ground with everybody. And that means that we're all going to be focused, I think, on affordability and access and accountability and all of those issues, because one thing I'm pretty sure of is that no matter what your point of view, you understand that higher education is the key to the American dream more and more, and that everybody needs some level of post-secondary education in this global knowledge economy. And I know that we can find common ground, and I have a history of being able to do that in my work in D.C. and in Texas, and hope to bring those skills to bear here.
Well, let's start with accountability and transparency. The NAACP has filed a public records request for the Board of Governors for documents. They say the process itself and the selection process itself was flawed. It wasn't transparent enough. Are you going to look into transparency and do anything about making things more transparent?
Well, let me start with making the comment about the search process itself. Of course, I had nothing to do with the process. I was simply one of the numerous candidates that went through it. And so as far as I'm concerned, it was a good result at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But you bet. I mean, I think transparency is important in government and in every area of life these days. And we'll urge the board to take some steps forward in that regard. We'll hope to stream meetings and, you know, have people more aware of what's going on and find ways for people to communicate directly with us in ways that they are satisfied. They're heard.
And I know that you're anxious to move forward, and I want to talk to you about your priorities and what you plan to do once you're finally here. But let's just take a look at some of the things that led up to this, because I think there's going to be a trust issue that I'm sure you're going to address in your tenure here. And it's around this process that in the process, not enough time was taken to let even the board know who the candidates were and what the – as you look back at the process for choosing – in this case, you as the new head of the system, is there room for? Can you understand why people are a little mistrustful about the way things happened, and is that a problem that you're going to have to address in terms of your relationship with the university community?
I can understand it, but Frank, I also can understand, and I think they can too, that, you know, legitimate candidates for public positions like this one. Want to make sure that you know, particularly if you're employed and you know, have a life of your own. I mean, I was not seeking this job. Others, I was approached by the person that did the search. You know, want to make sure that things are handled in an appropriate way. No legitimate candidate wants to offer themselves up for a public process that ends in failure, and I don't blame them. And so, I mean, I think there is a balance here between the needs of legitimate candidates and the public's need to know.
Let's talk about your priorities and what you're looking for. Your first action, even before you took over, was to hire a consulting firm to assess the system. What are you looking for? What are the outcomes that you want to take a look at and address in this system?
Well, as you know, I was named in late October and have just started today. So I knew there was going to be a bit of a gap as I finished up my service in Texas and so forth, and wanted to make sure that time was used in a way that I could gather information or use others that could gather information about how effective the general administration was, to get input about what we were proud of, what work needed to be done, and to get a lot of points of view from stakeholders of all kinds, policymakers, faculty, students, former Board of Governors members, and so forth. And they have done that and presented at the board retreat we had a couple of weeks ago some of the early findings. And I like to say that I'm pleased but not satisfied. We have a good foundation to build on, but certainly there's work to do, especially in this very, very critical time in higher education.
What are some of the things that pleased you?
Well, people in this system are very, very proud of what it means to this state. People understand in North Carolina that this is a unique asset that has differentiated North Carolina from many other states, all of the other states, mm-hmm. in fact. It's a unique governance model, and it is what has contributed to the prosperity and growth and intellectual vibrancy of this place, period, paragraph, and the right to be proud of it. But, as I said in my remarks to the Board of Governors, you know, we've done a good job and all around our country of educating elites to high levels, and we've made a lot of improvements in quality of life around the world. But the game is now how to educate many more people, particularly people of color, first generation, and others, to much higher levels. And we have a ways to go to say we've done that.
How do we do that?
Well, we start by making sure that our students are coming from our secondary schools prepared to do college-level work. And our role in that, in post-secondary education, is to make sure that we have a teacher corps. Most of the teachers that teach in North Carolina public schools come from these institutions. And so we need to make sure that they're very, very effective working with all sorts of learners so that those kids are ready to work on day one. Secondly, we need to make sure that we have a value proposition, if you will, offerings that people see are worthy of the investment of time and money that it will take. And thirdly, we need to work on affordability. You know, we have, I think, there's a lot of discussion around our country about the viability and the affordability of higher education in our country. And North Carolina fares very well. We're in the bottom quarter of public institutions in that regard, but it's still a lot of money.
Well, let's talk about the K-12 education that you say is critical, the preparedness for college. Mm-hmm. A lot of debate in this state over the past couple of years on how to fund public education. As you know, the state has a lot to say about and does fund public education around the state, which is almost unique in the country. Mm-hmm. And some real criticism that the state, when it had the chance to raise taxes or at least not cut taxes, could have spent more on public education. To date, we've still, the public education budget is still not where it was pre-2008. And so the criticism has been that the state legislature hasn't funded it properly and isn't concerned enough about K-12 as seen through the budget.
You know, I think when it comes to issues of resources, whether it's for K-12 or for post-secondary education, you know, we in education and any other endeavor that I've ever been affiliated with obviously want and need more resources. But I think our responsibility here is to talk about what's at stake and what are the outcomes. How well are we doing? What are our completion rates? How do we fare with respect to affordability? How do we fare with respect to college-level readiness? And so we need to be about the outputs and the outcomes and the results over just about how much do we spend. And I think when we get ahead of that and do a better job of talking to our publics, talking to policymakers and say, look, here's where we are, here's where we want to be, and here's what it's going to take for us to lead the nation, that's a front foot story, and that's the one I want to tell.
You've been in the forefront of public policy and education for years now. What are some of the things you can do to make those kind of improvements in outcomes, you know, with or without changes in the budget?
Well, I think we have to talk about what we have to agree upon. What's the definition of success? So whether it's, you know, number of students out of high school and at what level, do we have the kind of data and transparency systems in disaggregated ways so that we know how every single student is performing that can tell our story and make the case? In post-secondary education, I think we owe that to our publics there as well. So just, you know, demanding more resources without saying, you know, how we're going to meet an objective that we all share is only half the equation.
So what's your sense of that? What are your priorities? How would you measure success just out of K-12?
K-12 is, you know, how are we doing with respect to dropout prevention? Mm-hmm. How are we doing with respect to college level readiness or post-employment? How do we do with respect to kind of creating the school culture and climate that can cause people to be successful? All of these things, some more complicated than others, can be measured and can be reported. And that's true in post-secondary education.
So as you take on this new job, what are your top three priorities for this system?
Well, I think, as I said a minute ago, the number one thing that we need to do is to make sure that every North Carolinian who wants it has the opportunity to be successful in post-secondary education here, because we understand that that's the ticket to closing the income gap and achieving the American dream, period, paragraph. And that is our clarion call. And the way we'll do that is more and better information about what the unique mission is of each institution, what students can expect when they enroll there, how much it's going to cost, and how they're going to use those skills and opportunities in their own lives for the betterment of themselves as individuals and for the benefit of society.
So on that priority alone, certainly how we deliver the service is important, looking at the way it's delivered. Outcomes aren't based only on the amount of money that you spend on the process. But do you expect that you can get there better access for more people who right now don't have access and aren't graduating from our system? Can we get there without spending more money?
I don't know yet. I doubt it. But, you know, I don't have the information yet to make the case to the legislature about what specifically do we need to invest in. What should we do more of? What do we need to do less of? Or do we just simply need more resources?
My guest is Margaret Spelling. She's the new president of the UNC system, and our conversation is going to continue in a moment on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I invite you to stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today to Margaret Spelling. She is the new UNC system president, sharing her lunch hour today, although I guess you have another lunch date after this. So it's a busy day getting started on day one. Well, so one of the debates, obviously, about in the current discourse is around the central question. And we've I think, talked around it in our first segment. And that is, you know, what's the function of a university? And I think that the debate, and I can put it in schematic and oversimplify it, but a kind of direction in vocational training, you know, training students for jobs of tomorrow, and it's not an either-or proposition, but an emphasis on the kind of critical thinking that is inherent to, at this moment, a liberal education. Where do you see the direction of a university? Philosophically, what's the role of the university?
Well, these are incredibly complex institutions that are very unique, all 17 of them, and do everything from world-class healthcare and biomedical research and scholarship to fine arts and liberal arts to, you know, workforce preparation and everything in between. And I think that's what's so fantastic about this system, because it is fully vibrant and a feast of offerings for our students. And I think what I would say about that is it is everything. And what we need to do is provide excellent everything for people in ways that they want and need. And so, sure, am I naive about the fact that people, if they're going to invest their time and money, they want to, I certainly want this for my children, go out and get a job. There's nothing wrong with that. We shouldn't spurn that. But certainly the vibrancy of intellectual pursuit in every manner of scholarship is what is rich about these places as well. And it's not either or.
And I tell you, the reason it becomes an important question in North Carolina is because we've heard from the legislature and the governor. The governor frequently will talk about treating students as customers. And on the one hand, we all understand that along the lines you said, you know, if you pay money, a lot of money for an education, you want something in return.
Right.
There's a fear, and because of certain legislative initiatives, one I'll mention in particular, a bill that would require university professors to teach 8 classes. And the idea and the debate around that was, look, why aren't they working harder, as though this were some kind of industry that we could compare to manufacturing? There is a sense that critics would say, a growing sense that we're treating our universities as some kind of business with outcomes and measurements that don't apply in the university world. I mean, are you concerned that the discourse can take us down the wrong path?
Well, and I think a big part of my job is to explain you know, talk about the unique role that a university plays, both as an education and, to use your word, you know, customer offering in a very direct way to a place where scholarship is incubated and nurtured and developed. And those are both highly, highly valuable, but not the same thing. So for that second endeavor, obviously that person isn't going to teach 8 classes a day, can't teach 8 classes a day, and won't teach 8 classes a day. That person might be incubating research that will create tens of thousands of jobs, though. And so I think, you know, it's part of telling our story, and it's part of understanding the complexity of these institutions and the people in them.
So to be clear on that, you might have to stand up to a legislature and say, look, that's not what an institution does. This teaching is part of what they do, but the sort of incubation and research takes them out of the classroom and stand up for
of course.
Those.
I am proudly representative, the primary representative of this institution, and intend to speak on their behalf often and early.
There have been questions about your lack of an advanced degree. You and I have that in common. Neither one of us has an advanced degree.
Right.
However, you're the head of a university system. What about that critique that in this particular job, it really requires an advanced degree?
You know, I don't see it that way, obviously. I am not, and certainly make no bones about it. I'm not a scholar. I'm not a researcher. And, I'm not a teacher. What I am is a public policy maker and manager of a large enterprise that is interfacing in and with the public on their behalf. I have many decades of experience in doing just that in a state legislative environment and at the federal level. I know how to run something big. I know how to recruit talent. I know how to focus people around a task, and I hope I can bring those skills and do that here. I am not a substitute nor do I tend to compete with the people who are in these institutions and creating the intellectual vibrancy. I intend to be their advocate.
Advocate and supervisor, and I think there's where the question lies, where the business is generating this kind of degree, the absence, you as a supervisor, might be at a disadvantage as their boss.
You know, I've had many decades of experience in public policy in the education sector, including and especially in post-secondary education. I oversaw, all the federal policy related to that, including the funding and financing of it. I created a commission on the future of higher education that Governor Hunt served on, and created a very important piece of work around what our goals and federal obligations are. So this is not unfamiliar territory for me at all. And I think there's plenty of work for everybody. And I bring different skills than those of a scholar, but they're very needed.
What are those skills?
Well, I'm a policymaker, an advocate. I'm a communicator. I am someone who understands how state budgets work, how the public interfaces with its government. I understand what the landscape is in public policy and education, not only in our country, but around the world. And I have many decades of experience in working in this realm.
But let's talk about some of that public policy. No Child Left Behind was a program that you didn't create, but you certainly helped implement as George W. Bush's education secretary. And I would have to say that it is one of the few issues that has brought both Republicans and Democrats together. That is to say, they have overturned that policy in a bipartisan way. What do you make of what happened
well,
to No
Frank,
Child Left Behind?
I don't see it that way. In fact, the new reauthorization, the ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, preserves the fundamental guts of No Child Left Behind, and that is annual assessment of every student every year and reporting that information, that data, in a disaggregated way. That is the, essence of No Child Left Behind and holding ourselves accountable to do something about it. I'm proud that, Ted Kennedy and John Boehner and George Miller and George Bush came together and passed that legislation with broad bipartisan margins. I was there at the birth of it, and the guts of it were preserved and affirmed just a few weeks ago when the Congress reauthorized it.
Well, the part of it, though, was the penalties that would be faced by schools that didn't meet those targets, and that in some ways that were punishing schools that were already under the gun, and that has changed.
And that has changed. And I call this the renewed era of local control. So we're going to see how serious local state and local policymakers are about closing the achievement gap. They've got the ball now. And while the consequences piece of No Child Left Behind has now been devolved to local and state authorities, we'll see how well that works. We've tried an approach like that for many, many decades, and we had a very wide achievement gap. No Child Left Behind, most importantly, focused like a laser our attention and our resources around the needs of poor and minority students, and even educators, often whom oppose this law, will accede to that.
Absolutely. The early critics of No Child Left Behind do acknowledge that one of the things it did in terms of the critics will acknowledge is did focus attention on underachievement and minorities who were being underserved by our school systems in the way that any progressive policies in the past had not. And the disaggregated part, I think, is important. What you're saying is not average for a school system,
correct,
but
yeah,
who's succeeding and who's failing in those schools and what to do about that.
Right.
So here's the question. We know we've got some pretty good statistics on who's winning and who's losing, who's succeeding and who's failing in those statistics. We find that people of color and certainly people who are underprivileged, low-wealth families are doing worse. In general, when we know that, and I know there are more specifics that we need to get, what do we do about that? We know they're being underserved. How do we change that?
Well, they are, and you know. But however, we have made progress under the regime of No Child Left Behind. What gets measured gets done, and the fact that we had to attend to their needs really did, provide great improvement for those populations. That's why the civil rights community fought so hard to include those provisions of No Child Left Behind in this new law. But what we're going to do about it, obviously, is particularly in our post-secondary institutions, understand what the research-based practices are that are going to move the needle. I mean, what are the kinds of things that it will take for us to get every child succeeding at grade level and beyond. And so our higher ed institutions owe our schools that. We also need teachers who go into our classrooms every day, both as role models and as effective practitioners that can help close the achievement gap. And we're a long way from doing it. I mean, my head explodes when I think, well, how can we say that all the schools are good, all the teachers are good, but, you know, half of our minority kids are getting out on time? That just doesn't add up for me.
Well, you called in a message you sent to the system today that we need to see education as a new civil right. On the theory that everybody has a right to a public education in most states, what has to change to really ensure that people who aren't being served now are actually going to get that right? And to see that the outcomes are better than they are today.
Well, we're going to start with agreeing on what those measurements are and ought to be and how we're going to hold ourselves accountable for the progress along the way, understanding that we have 16 different unique institutions with different populations and different missions. And so my hope is that we'll have a very clear understanding with each one of those chancellors around what those objectives are, and that we're going to also bring to bear some resources and some practices about how we're going to move the needle. But I think we have to be very clear, what do we want and expect? And I don't think we are clear enough about that today in our state or in our country.
On another subject, you served on the board of the Apollo Education Group, and that's the parent company of the University of Phoenix. That's a for-profit university. It's under federal investigation now for its business and marketing practices. That school has a graduation rate of about 7%, which is lower than the national average, and a loan default rate of 20%, which is higher than the national average. How did you address, assuming that was going on while you were on the board, were you aware of that, and did you address those concerns?
So, I don't know what the facts specifically were during my tenure on the board many years ago, but I would say a couple things. One is our for-profit institutions, the University of Phoenix and many others, serve some of the most disadvantaged students in the population. So that's part of the story as well. I would say, and I learned a lot about how to meet the needs of our students through that experience, which is technology-based. I mean, it is a way that people, largely working adults, get higher education and credentials in ways that are convenient and affordable for them. And so I think we can take a page from their book and are in the public sector about how to provide our offerings in ways that our students can access them.
Yeah, I guess the contention is whether they're being served with a graduation rate of 7%. I mean, they're going, and the federal investigation has to do with the way federal money, particularly GI loans, are being taken quite efficiently, and yet with a graduation rate of 7%, they're really not being served.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to the specific graduation rate. I'm not sure that, I mean, I don't know how recent that fact is, if it was during my time in service and so forth. But I think what we know.
Do you know, what was the graduation rate? You were on the board. What was the graduation rate when you were there?
I do not know. I mean, it was many years ago. I certainly don't know off the top of my head. I can certainly find out. But, I mean, I guess the point is this. You know, this is the proposition where, in your particular example, veterans have access to resources. And they use that as a voucher, if you will, to go find in the marketplace credentials and education that can help advance their careers. And many of that population, whether they're veterans or otherwise, are non-traditional students. They are working. Many of them are, you know, recovering from their service overseas, et cetera. And so it's a difficult population to serve, more so than what you'll find in many of our public systems.
You know, there's a great push, particularly in conservative circles, to move toward more privatized education through vouchers and in some cases charter schools, although they are public schools. This move to privatize, though, again, gets you into a situation where you have less transparency than more. Do you think privatization is the answer to some of our problems?
You know, here's what I know, Frank, is that there is plenty of work for everybody. And I believe we have, you know, upwards of 225,000 students in this system right now, that we, when we offer a value proposition in terms of affordability and quality and utility for our students, they will find it. And so, but I think that, you know, we ought to welcome any and all providers, whether they're nonprofit providers like Western Governors University, certainly the institutions in this system, and others. There, we have 1.5 million people in this state who have some level of college without completion and credential. And so, as I say, there's plenty of work for everybody.
Well, it's one thing to welcome and another to encourage through public policy. And so a question is, again, given the transparency differential between any public institution with all of its guidelines and rules about transparency, private institutions, which have far fewer, do we as public servants encourage more private education given the lack of or the lesser transparency?
Well, I think we should be very hawkish about transparency with all types of institutions. And certainly I've called for that during my days as the U.S. Secretary of Education. People ought to understand, you know, what are they paying? What are their prospects? How long will it take for them to complete? What, you know, what are the graduation rates and so on? And so I stand for that for every type of institution. And I think, you know, when we empower our consumer with information, they'll make good choices.
One of the challenges for any university, particularly here in North Carolina, is the intersection of academics and athletics. It has posed many challenges for this system and our flagship institution as well, most notably UNC Chapel Hill. What's your perspective on the role of athletics and academics?
Well, obviously it's part of the college experience, clearly, but it is, these institutions were created for the prime directive, obviously, is for education and opportunity. And that is our clarion call and our most important mission. There are a lot of things that go on college campuses that are important additive experiences. That's one of them. But, you know, I see this primarily, obviously, as an academic institution.
Let me ask you about a couple of more issues quickly as we're running out of time. The role of HBCUs in our university system.
Yes.
It's had a very important role and a history. How do you see the role of those universities and what's going to be, how do you focus your attention on the needs of HBCUs?
Yeah, well, I think they have a very unique and important mission. And as I said, not precisely enough, that I think my job is to work with the chancellors of these 16 institutions and, of course, the statewide Mass Science High School as well, to understand what is that unique mission and what is the definition of excellence uniquely for those 16, and to, you know, get into an understanding of how we know excellent when we get there, and they obviously will chart their path to success. And so I understand that every one of these institutions is very, very unique and serves different parts of the community and so forth. So I'm anxious, by the way, to get about the state over the next 100 days and see all these places and listen and learn.
Well, members of LGBT communities have expressed concern about statements you made in the past, particularly your reference to those lifestyles, the lifestyles of gay and lesbian people in our community. What's your view on LGBT inclusion on college campuses?
Regrettably, I repeated the questioner's use of that term during my press conference shortly after I was named, and I apologize for that. I will tell you that just yesterday I sent a letter to the faculty council that passed a resolution last Thursday at the UNC Chapel Hill campus indicating my strong support for diversity of all kinds and echoing, adding my voice to that call. There were some specific issues in the resolution that are more rightfully raised at the campus, and that is, you know, resources around particular types of programs that obviously Carol Fulton and her team will be addressing. But absolutely, I think when I say education is the new civil right, I mean that in every sense of the word.
Margaret Spellings, thank you so much for taking this time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Frank.
Margaret Spellings is the new president of the UNC system. Just ahead, a new theater project explores experiences of military service members and their families. Stay with us on The State of Things.